Hi, and welcome to Interviews with the Masters, brought to you by theoutdoorinsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear. Today we have on the phone eight-time world champion, elk caller, and the man behind the best elk hunting site, Elk 101's Corey Jacobson. Hey, Corey, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm good, man. Getting all my ducks in a row here and getting my stuff ready. And my first hunting trip's coming up pretty quick here in July. So I'm trying to get everything together for that. It's coming up hot. So
definitely. Used to wish it would come a little quicker every year, and it seems like every year it comes a little bit faster, and now it's like, man, I wish I just had one more week or one more month, and things just they come upon us a little bit more quickly than they used to, it seems.
Yep, that's for sure. Well, Corey, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and a little bit about Elk 101.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love elk hunting, and that's my passion. You know, I think we all have our specialty. I love hunting anything, but I really love elk hunting, and just being born and raised in elk country and having an opportunity to do it from a young age kind of instilled that passion. And now it's kind of turned more into I love seeing other people get the thrill that comes from elk hunting. And so about 8 years ago, I created a website called elk101.com, and the whole purpose for it was just to educate people on every aspect of elk hunting. So, you know, whether it's somebody that never hunted before, how to get started, whether it's somebody that needed some help on calling, just all sorts of articles, tactics, videos, information, anything you can think of relating to elk hunting, we put on there, and it's exploded and done really well, and just allows me a platform to be able to share my passion for.
I think it's a phenomenal resource. I mean, I use
it
all. I've read a lot of those articles and. You know, kind of been following you for some time. I can use some, as much help as I can get in the elk woods.
And that's it. I've been hunting elk for over 30 years with a bow, and I still consider myself I don't know if I'd say an immature student, but a student with a lot left to learn. And there's every time I step in the elk woods, if I'm not learning something, I've wasted time out there because.
Yeah.
There's a lot to learn for sure.
And that's a common thread I find behind all successful hunters is that they consider themselves a student and they're always trying to learn and get better. I think if you go in with that mindset, there's a lot of people out there, especially in the hunting industry, or not the hunting industry, but just in hunting in general, that. It's very ego-driven, and everybody thinks they know everything, and it's like, and I feel like those are the guys that don't succeed, or
they burn out. You know, people see through that, and they really do. The average hunter, which I consider myself to be in that group, there's just a commonality there. I can't explain it, but. We see when somebody comes in and pretends to be something they aren't. And it's like anything in life. You have to earn it, When it comes to success as a hunter, it's not handed out, You have to earn that. And there are some that try to cut in front of the line and usually ends up coming back to bite them. But, there's egos in every sport, in every industry, and hunting's no different.
No, that's for sure.
Everything that we do with Elk 101 is focused around educating and helping, and there's, hopefully not any kind of a perception of ego there because, we get humbled on a regular basis out in the elk woods, so we're all trying
to
learn together and improve together.
For sure. So a little bit about Interviews with the Masters. Podcast is a little bit different. We collect questions from the various websites that I'm associated with and my social media. And we take these questions, we compile them, and once we have enough in a certain category, we find the guy that's best suited to answer them. So these questions come from people asking them of me. And, so I'm going to shoot them at you. You know, guys right now are gearing up for elk season, especially here in Arizona. The draw results came out, you know, while ago. Everybody's chomping at the bit, and you know, so I said, who can I go to? You know, I'm like, let me go pick Corey's brain on this, because he's the man. If you want some elk information, so I got a few questions for you. First one we got here is, in early season or the rut, what tactics can you share with our listeners that would help them score a bull in the early season? Right? It's kind of a generalized question, but you know,
totally.
So you know, pick three or four of your, you know,
go-to tactics,
best, I guess, your go-to.
Yeah. So for me, and I've been fortunate to actually hunt Arizona twice. I got in mm-hmm. both times that there were issues with the non-resident tag allocations, and happened to slip in and draw pretty decent tags twice. So I've had the fortune of experiencing Arizona rut hunts with a bow, and there's nothing like it. And there's two phases of that early season. There's the pre-rut, and then there's the rut. And fortunately for Arizona, that, you know, that rut hunt, whether it's archery or rifle or muzzleloader, those fall basically in the peak of the rut. So, you know, your tactics there, at least my go-to tactic is calling. The earlier part of that, you know, the first few days of that archery season, can be tough for calling. The big bulls especially haven't really come and rounded up the cows. The smaller bulls might be running with the herd and pretty vocal, but those smaller bulls are sometimes a little more timid. And then once the big bulls come in and get with the cows, it can be more difficult to pull them away because they're focused primarily on breeding. But my go-to strategy, especially in Arizona, with any of those seasons that fall, September, early October, is going to focus heavily around calling. And, you know, when I went to Arizona the first time, everyone told me that was my first out-of-state hunt. I'm in Idaho, and so we hunt over-the-counter public land, mm-hmm. tons of people, not managed for trophy, not managed for, you know, quality bugling experiences. And everyone said, just take a cow call, because the elk you can't bugle in bulls in Arizona.
No, that's not true.
And we went down there, and I think the first 2 days we messed up on 8 or 9 setups, because we were used to hunting Idaho and being aggressive and having to run after these bulls, pressure them. And we'd run about 100 yards and the bull would be coming in there running at us. And so we quickly learned, if a bull bugles, get set up quickly, because he's going to come in. And, you know, that's not always the case.
No, but yeah.
Yeah, the bulls in Arizona were very responsive to bugles. And the next time I went, it was a drought year. It was a full moon. So, you know, there was some difficulties associated with it, but we still had really good response. So I guess to kind of maybe go into a little bit more detail on the actual calling sequence, you can't just go out and blow a, or, you know, squeeze a hoochie mama a couple times and blow a couple bugles and expect the elk to come running to you. I think practicing with calls right now is important to sound as realistic as you can. Mm-hmm. But couple of the key points when it comes to calling an elk, and, you know, this goes for Arizona or anywhere, but you have to put emotion into your bugles, and you have to think about, or any of your calls, cow calls or bugles, and you really need to think about, what is that elk going to respond to? And if you're trying to portray an emotion in those calls, there's really just two emotions that the elk are going to respond to with calls, and that's the desire to breed and the desire to fight. And you've got to elicit that response through your calling. So if you're trying to convince the bull that you're a cow that needs bread, you've got to give him that sound. And, you know, similar for bugles, if you want to convince that bull that there's a reason to come in and fight, you've got to challenge him and make a fight. So putting emotion in the calls is important, and then getting close. The closer you can get to that elk before you set up and start calling to him, the higher the chances of that bull coming into the cows or coming into the calls, whether it's cows or bugles.
What's like a real, like, you know, trying to be specific and give me like a, you know, a setup. What do you look for? I mean, I obviously, you know, terrain's terrain. It's going to be whatever it's going to be, wherever the elk are at.
Totally.
But, you know, what do you try to do to, you know, stack the odds in your favor that if this bull is going to come in to your call, what do you do to set up and, you know, make it so that you have an opportunity to actually get a shot off.
Yeah, for sure. So there's three things really. And like you said, you can't choose the setup necessarily as far as terrain or, you know, where the bull's hanging out, but there's some things definitely that you can do to increase the chances of a close encounter. First thing is the wind. And I think a lot of people, a lot of hunters, they pay attention to the wind, but they don't utilize it the way it should be utilized, and they don't recognize how important it is because the elk are utilizing it continually. So paying attention to the wind and making your approach and your setup structured so that when the elk comes in, he's not going to wind you. And he feels comfortable coming in, feels like he's protected, but he isn't able to smell you. So paying attention to that wind as you're approaching and as you get set up is very critical. The second component, and it may be the most important component when it comes to calling in an elk, is getting in close. If you bugle at an elk from 500 yards and he's responding and you're giving him everything that sounds great and doing all you can to bring him in, there's not a high percentage chance that bull's going to actually commit to your call and come in from that distance. But if you slip into 150, you know, as close as you can get, sometimes it's 100 yards. Sometimes it's open country and it's noisy walking. You can't get closer than 180 or 200 yards. But every step that you can get closer to that elk, the chances of him coming into your calls goes up. And if you can get inside that 150-yard mark, it's your odds go up exponentially. And then the last one is just the actual calling sequence. And for me, if I want that bull to come in to me, I have to challenge him. I have to get him coming to me. And if he bugles and I wait 30 seconds and respond, and then 2 minutes goes by and he bugles again and I respond, it's not the same. Or if I bugle and wait 30 seconds and he responds and I wait 2 minutes, the conversation is completely different. So I like to make sure that every time he bugles, I hammer him immediately with a challenge. I cut him off, let him know that I'm not only talking to him, but that I'm issuing a challenge to him. And if I start out with a bugle, if I'm in my setup and I start out with a bugle and he answers that bugle right back, he's issued the challenge to me and basically said, you come up here, I'm standing my ground. So I've got to turn it on him. So I always like to start my calling sequence with a cow call and get the bull to respond. And as soon as he responds, then I cut him off with a bugle. And I just keep going through that sequence, getting him to talk first and then issue the challenge immediately after to him. And it's
makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's not a foolproof 100% guarantee, but it's definitely one of the most efficient and effective simplified calling tactics.
And it's easier to do, it's easier to remember. I mean, there's you can get a lot more technical and, you know, speaking elk language to you know, improve your chances. But for somebody who doesn't have the time to learn every vocalization and everything else, but that, I mean, that makes sense. And challenge bugle and cow calling and using it at the right timing. I want to circle back to what you said about the wind. Where do you like to have the wind? You know, if you had an ideal setup, you know, is it in your face? Is it perpendicular to it, to you, you know?
You know, and everyone always says, get the wind in your face, you know, wind coming at you. When you understand thermals, you know, thermals are basically, they're very simple. Obviously, there's a lot of complex factors that can change them and alter them. But in a nutshell, in the morning, the thermals are coming down, downhill, down drainage, downhill, all of that. And then as the sun warms up the ground, that temperature difference causes the thermals to change direction, and they start pulling up drainage, uphill, upslope. And that transition time is probably the most volatile time because it's, you know, swirling as the temperatures are changing. Cloud cover comes over and it can completely change the temperature of the ground and go back down and back up. But ultimately, even during those changes, the wind's either going down or up. And that means if you are directly below the elk and the thermals are coming down and they switch suddenly, they're going to go straight up. And so I like to get off to the side and approach the elk from the perpendicular position, you know, in accordance with the thermals. So I'm coming across at him, and that way if the thermals do change, the odds of the scent going up or down to the elk are greatly minimized. And also, you know, it puts that elk in a position. If I'm at the same level on the hill as that elk, which would put me perpendicular to the thermals, there are a couple other big advantages. That elk, you know, if they get on a high point and I'm coming from down below them, they have a visual advantage, and they're usually going to stand there and hold their ground on that high point and wait until they get visual confirmation that, hey, there is an elk coming up towards me before they come any closer. So if they get to a high knob where they have a visual advantage, it's going to be hard to pull that elk in closer, and they're going to see you before you get close enough to them to get a shot. And then the other thing is, if you're above the elk, it's hard to pull that elk up a hill because they're at a physical disadvantage. They're, in their mind, they're coming into a challenging bull, and coming up the hill puts them at a physical disadvantage. So getting on the same level as that elk definitely adds a lot to the effectiveness of bringing that elk in, both from a thermal and from a visual and physical standpoint.
Well, that's good info, man. I don't think people invest enough time into thinking about once they're in there, within that kill range, you know, or that calling range, the where, you know, where to come in from and how to set up. I think that's one of the things that, you know, people spend a lot of time learning how to do the call and, you know, spend a lot of time shooting and so on and so forth. But then they come home empty-handed because, no, they come home with a lot of stories about the one that got away because they don't have that last bit of information there to make it, you know.
Totally, and it's tough in a state like Arizona. I've done a couple of seminars and hunting classes down there, and you know, you show up in January and nobody's interested in elk because they haven't found out if they've drawn, and then you go back in July and it's like the people who have drawn are absorbing as much information as they can. But the thing that amazes me and disappoints me maybe a little bit is, so many people that hunt Arizona, they draw that tag, and it, you know, takes 10, 15 years, whatever it takes to draw. And for that 10 or 15 years, they haven't gone on any other elk hunt. So they get this prime elk tag and all of this expectation with no real experience for hunting elk. And that experience is so important, just to, you know, these little things of paying attention to the wind, getting on the same level,
For sure.
understanding the elk's, you know, body language, just all these little things that only come through experience. And so I always encourage people, if you're waiting on a once in a lifetime type tag, go and buy an over-the-counter tag somewhere and just go on a couple elk hunts to get your feet wet.
Yeah, I mean that could be said about, you know, a number of different states that are just there's no over-the-counter opportunity. I mean, even for deer and everything else, you see that all the time. You know, when I did some guiding, you know, I loved having those Midwest hunters come in, you know, the whitetail hunters, because, you know, those guys killed deer every year. And they knew, you know, when the time came and that buck stepped out, they knew, you know, how to fall into it and put the shot where it needed to go and so on and so forth. And then you got guys, you know, on the out, you know, out west that have been waiting 6 years, 7 years for a tag and haven't really hunted. And, you know, they fall apart because they don't have that experience. So yeah, it's important, you know, go on buddies hunts and whatever, just kind of, you know, experiences. There's nothing that, you know, is better than having some experience underneath the belt when you're out there. So.
Absolutely. You know, we can, through seminars and the website and everything, we can teach people, you know, concepts, tactics, all of that, that will definitely shorten their learning curve. But there's nothing in the world that's going to take the place of being there and experiencing it. And, you know, with education and knowledge, you can couple that with experience and learn much, you know, more quickly in the field. But yeah, to step out there for your first day of elk hunting with the tag you waited 15 years for, you know, your expectations to kill are probably pretty unrealistic, which, you know, is I think illustrated in success rates. You get these prime units, but success rates are still only 40 or 50%. I think it's that experience factor that makes the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to move on to the next question here. It's about, you know, so I got this question. For those of us who have cow tags, you know, what tips and tricks can you give us for filling that tag? Basically, you know, during their rut, it's, you know, you could call in bulls, you can do other things to get a bull to come in, but the cows are still, you know, the same year round pretty much. So
totally.
What would you suggest guys to, we got a cow tag and want to fill a cow tag, put some meat in the freezer.
Yeah. You know, and that we focus so much when it comes to elk hunting, you know, there's the thrill of it for me is in calling an elk and that bugling interaction, a big bull screaming in your face. And the reality is there's far fewer bull tags issued than there are cow tags. And part of, you know, just the state management of the herds, more cow tags are issued and fewer bull tags. So there are definitely more people, I think, especially in Arizona and other states where it's mostly limited entry draws, where cow tags are the focus. And in my opinion, it's harder to hunt the cow during the rut than it is to hunt a bull during the rut.
For sure.
The bulls are vocal. They're not in their right frame of mind, I guess, to survive. And cows always are. The cow, like you said, the cows don't change a whole lot from day to day or season to season. So the thing to remember with the cows is what they're doing from day to day. And basically they're eating, they're drinking, and they're sleeping. And,
right.
You know, so I think it's important to understand food sources, to understand where the elk are going to feed, water sources, especially in Arizona where water is so critical and those elk are hitting water every day, understanding where those are located, and then bedding areas. And if you can triangulate those three things, you can pretty much pattern those elk, and they're going to be in the same general pattern throughout the season. And, you know, if you bugle, if there's a bull there during the rut, there's probably going to be cows there. So if you can learn to call in elk, it's probably going to put you in the middle of the herd, and if you have a cow tag, it's definitely going to benefit you. But I think if it was me, especially in a state like Arizona, where they are so dependent on water, you know, I'd probably focus more on ambush than calling and just find a good location where I've got, you know, I can set up a trail camera and find a bunch of elk that are coming through and pattern them and, you know, set up that way. But calling's, you know, still you get the excitement of calling and getting close, you just focus more on the cows.
For sure. What would you suggest our listeners do to score a bull in like a late archery season? You know, something after the rut when they're not really responding to calls and so on and so forth. I'm actually kind of interested in this one myself since I drew a 5B tag in November here, archery tag.
Totally. You know, late season's tough, and that's my son turned, in Idaho where they can hunt at 10, and they changed the law when he was 11, so I all of a sudden got thrown in a year early to take any youth out hunting, and he wasn't old enough to draw his bow to the minimum weight at the time, so we were stuck rifle hunting in a later season, and it shook me a little bit because I'm so focused on archery hunting during the rut that it's like, hey, hold on, what do I have to, if this is a whole new tactic to learn how to hunt after the rut and get close, and it's kind of like hunting for cows. It comes down to locating the bulls and focusing on what they need, and during that time after the rut, the bulls usually pull back by themselves and, you know, they'll bachelor up a little bit heading into winter and move into some pretty remote areas. They don't want pressure. They want to get away and rest and rebuild after the rut and get ready for the winter. So you're going to find them, you know, pulled back away from where the cows and the rest of the herds are. And they don't want to move a whole lot if they don't have to. So, you know, once they find a food source and water source with good cover in close proximity, they're going to tuck themselves there, and, you know, you might only see them the last half hour of day, the first half hour in the morning,
yeah.
And they're going to be nearly as visible as the rest of the herds, especially the more mature bulls. So during that late season, I think it's important to use optics, you know, get up high first thing in the morning and just glass as much country as you can and try to pinpoint where the bulls are and see where they're going, because they probably aren't moving too far during that time of year. And pattern them then, and then, you know, get in, especially archery late season. That's a tough hunt for sure, but it can be very productive, and you can get those bulls that aren't moving a lot. And but I definitely focus a lot on optics and getting high and spotting some elk.
Yeah, I had same tag, different unit. I had a 7 East tag in 2011, and I shot a bull. And it was, you know, I just kind of handled it like deer hunting. Like you said, just got up on knobs and glass. And it was funny, though, because that year, the bulls were still with the cows. And there were still nosing cows around. They weren't bugling. But, you know, they were showing, you know, some rutting activity, you know, trying to breed cows and stuff. And it was interesting. And then a following year, I went with a buddy and helped them on a rifle hunt, which is, it starts the day after that archery season ends. And like you said, the bulls were, you know, bachelored up and they were just up high and away from everything. And my wife, Maria, had a bull elk hunt rifle, same late hunt, this past November, and same scenario, the bulls weren't with cows and they were just, and I don't, it's just funny. I don't know if it's just that, you know, week's time change right there between, you know, when I was hunting with the archery season or not, or just the weather or what, but it was just weird.
You know, there are a lot of dynamics that go into the rut, and moisture in the spring affects the rut, moisture through the summer affects the rut, moisture during the rut affects the rut,
right?
Temperature, moon phases, all of these different things, hunting pressure, different things that really affect the rut. And any cow that doesn't get bred during the first rut, which is usually that, you know, 20th of September through the first week of October, if a cow doesn't get bred, then she'll actually come back into an estrus cycle 28 days later. So a lot of times you'll get a second rut during that last week of October, you know, mid to late October. And the cows that don't get bred then will actually maybe cycle again 28 days after that. So that mid-October or mid-November time frame, sometimes you will get a little flurry of rutting action. Sometimes you'll actually have calling. You know, it's not going to be the aggressive calling where you can call elk in, but at least for locating bulls, if there are a few cows that didn't get bred, sometimes the bulls will come back around to finish that breeding. And that may be what you saw that year you were up there late, was a second or a third rut hitting. And like you say, not a lot of bugling action, but bulls still with cows and still pushing them. And the ones,
yeah,
that hadn't got bred, still looking to breed them.
So one of the biggest bulls of my life on that hunt.
Yes.
Oh, I tried like heck to get them, but it didn't happen. So I got a few people ask me questions about scent attraction, attractants. And early on in my elk hunting career, I used them, but I haven't used them probably in 10 years. Do you use scent attractants, like, you know, bull pee and estrus and all that stuff?
So funny story, I was in Arizona, a friend of mine had drawn a tag, and so me and another buddy went down just to tag along and kind of do a little pre-scouting for if we were to draw that unit, and he killed a bull, and we had an extra day or two, and there was another hunter in the unit that was one of those hunters that didn't have experience. You know, he hadn't hunted elk before, and he was struggling to get into elk, and so we said, hey, well, we don't have a tag, we'd love to go and call in elk for you, and kind of just tag along. So we went out the first evening and we're walking along, and he had a scent wafer dangling from a string off the back of his hat.
Uh-huh.
And it stunk. I mean, we could smell it walking behind him. It was not a pleasant smell. And we stopped to take a break, and we got up and walked about 200 yards, and he started turning around, and he was panicked, and he said, you know, my scent wafer fell off. Where'd it go? We need to look for it. And, you know, looked around on the ground there for 20 or 30 yards and couldn't find it. And anyway, got done hunting that night, got back to the truck, and my buddy who was with me turned to me, and he's like, hey, that guy lost his scent wafer, huh? And I said, yeah, he must have. And he said, no, I took it off his hat and buried it under a rock when we stopped to rest. He was like, I couldn't stand that thing walking behind it. So my thoughts on scents are, if an elk can smell that scent wafer, he can smell you, because that,
yep,
scent's going in the exact same direction. So a scent wafer, scent on your boots, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
If the thermals are moving towards the elk to allow them to smell that scent wafer, it's taking every bit of stink that you have on you and moving it to them as well. So they can,
right,
differentiate that there's two separate smells there and one's danger, and it can,
yeah,
be tough. So I'll use like a scent neutralizer, just, you know, the spray, and I'll spray,
yeah,
it on my pack and
that's
on myself.
Free.
And all that really does, it's not going to make you so you can walk right to an elk with the wind blowing at it, but it might minimize that scent cone and reduce the angle that the scent's going out and get that elk another 10 yards into your shooting lane before he does wind you, so it just buys a little more advantage. But I'm 100% believer in obeying the wind, and there's no better scent control than just keeping the wind in your favor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of scent eliminating research. I was a field researcher for a company, and I did 4 years of research. And what I've come up with is that scent elimination is key. I do keep all my clothes. I change everything, every single hunt that I have, every single day. I change my camo. I do try to shower and spray down as much as possible for the reason, and you kind of touching on this, that, yeah, you're not going to be able to eliminate everything. And, yeah, once you start hiking around, you start sweating, you start generating other odors and so on and so forth. But it might make that deer, that elk, that whatever it is that you're stalking, think, that's real minimum. He's either further away than, you know, than he really is, or he already passed through here at one point. It's older scent. And, like, I've had times where, and I'll equate this to whitetail hunting, because that's probably where the biggest scent elimination, because you're sitting in a tree and you don't really can't really play the wind. Where a deer will come by and they'll hit your scent cone, and instead of busting out, they'll stop for a second. You know, because it's minimal, and again, like, I don't know what's going through their head. Obviously, I'm not a deer, but I'm assuming it's a human walked through here at one point, and not, oh, there's a human right there right now. Yeah. And it gives you that extra opportunity, even if it's just a couple of seconds, to get drawn back and shoot. Then, you know, I've also been in a tree stand. One time I had a kid that was filming me, and he showed up smelling like weed. I was like, well, dude, what are you doing? What is this? You know, he was not my cameraman. He was given to me from I don't want to get into it, because I don't want to make anybody upset. But anyway, every time a deer came down the trail and hit our scent, they blew out of there like instantaneously. And I've never, ever, ever had that happen since I've been practicing my scent controlling and so on and so forth. But anyway, so that's my 2 cents on that.
Totally. Yeah. They're going to smell you, and they're going to be alerted to the fact there's danger there. But the more you can minimize your scent, the more advantage it's going to buy in. You know, we're all looking for every advantage we can, and yeah. Scent is it's the one thing that animals focus on and rely on to stay alive. And so anything we can do to minimize our imprint, our effect in that regard is definitely going to benefit us as hunters.
My next question I have for you is about scouting. And this is not, don't be specific to Arizona. Just give me your plan for scouting. How do you locate and how do you keep tabs on bulls that are in the early season, so that you can, work them once archery season comes around?
For sure. So for me, where we hunt in Idaho, we aren't focused on finding a specific big bull and staying on it through the season. It's too difficult. First off, we don't have a whole lot of big bulls, but what I'm looking for is a mature representative bull for the area that I'm hunting. And I've done it before where I've found bulls throughout the summer and like, oh, that's a monster. I'm going to keep tabs on him. And especially in states like, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, some of the mountain states, those bulls will move sometimes 10, 12, 15 miles once the rut kicks in to go look for cows. So you spend all summer, you're up scouting every weekend, you keep tabs on this bull, and then season opens and he disappears. And it's like, man, what happened? He's a ghost, He went looking for cows. And so I've changed my focus on scouting, especially on those kind of, public land over-the-counter hunts, where I'm not focused so much on the size of the bull or a specific bull. I've changed my focus to finding the cows in the summer, and I look for the biggest group of cows that I can find, because if there's 60 or 80 cows in an area, That's going to attract a lot of bulls. It's going to attract the bigger bulls, and the rutting activity is going to be a lot better there. If I only find six or eight cows, there might be a bull or two around, but it's just not going to be as competitive, and the hunt's not going to be as exciting or productive potentially. So my scouting in the summer is finding, you know, big groups of cows and keeping tabs on them, because typically where the cows have their calves, you know, this time of year, early June, they're going to stay in that same general area throughout the summer. They've got cover, they've got feed, they've got water right there, and they're going to stay there throughout the summer, and that's typically the area that the bulls are going to come to as they start looking for the cows once the rut kicks in. So if I can find the cows, you know, now through August, that's probably where the rut's going to take place, in early to mid-September. And so my focus for scouting is finding cows. And it's tough because sometimes you can't get into the unit and set up trail cameras or do scouting physically until season starts. So it can be difficult. But there are a lot of resources out there.
There's a ridiculous rule, I think.
Yeah.
Montana does that too.
Yep, totally. So, you know, there's a lot of resources. Google Earth has been incredible. Both times I hunted Arizona, I went there without having set foot in the unit, and I done all my scouting with Google Earth, and we hit the ground running, and we're into elk immediately. And obviously Arizona's an anomaly. There are elk. You can throw a dart at a map. And, yeah.
Here in New Mexico. And yeah. I even think some places in Nevada, too, but it's, I mean, Utah. Any of those really tough-to-draw states, I mean, I always tease people, you know, I tease my friends here in Arizona, you know, tell them we're the worst elk hunters there are. You know, you go to any other state, they'll kick our ass because they have to really, really, really work a lot harder than we do.
It's,
you know,
it's
we got to get over here,
experience.
Man.
Experience.
Yeah, you got to elk do what they're supposed to do. They do what the books and all the videos tell you they're going to do.
Exactly. So. Just, you know, the pressure from other hunters and the predators, especially in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, where there's wolves now.
Yeah.
Those two factors alone make the elk a completely different animal to hunt. You come to Arizona or places where they don't get the same pressure from hunters. They don't have the same predator pressure, and they act differently. They just aren't as on edge. And so, yeah, it doesn't take necessarily the same effort, but at the same time, they're a wild animal,
I certainly
don't want people to get the impression. Yeah, you got to earn it, no matter where you're hunting.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. So, well, I have one last question for you. And I think it'd be pretty easy. I kind of know where you're going to go with it before you go with it. if I was not very mobile and I had to stand hunt or hunt out of a blind, for elk, what would you suggest? And again, not just related to Arizona, cause that's a pretty easy answer. It's, you know, sit water, but, you know, what would you do? Like, you know, some of those boreal rainforest we got up there in the Northwest and stuff like that, where water's everywhere. And
totally, yeah, you know, it really comes down to scouting at that point. Elk are very patternable, especially before the rut kicks in. So if I was mobile, or, you know, not able to be mobile and relegated to hunting out of a tree stand or a blind, scouting is going to be important. But that early season, elk can be patterned, and they're in more of a feeding pattern. You locate food sources and water sources, even in areas where there's a lot of water. Elk are going to get their water from plants. They're going to get it from multiple water sources. It's going to be harder to pattern, but their movements are going to be pretty consistent, especially where they're feeding. They're going to come out, you know, on the edges of clear cuts, edge of logging areas, open hillsides, and find those. Yeah, so that transition, the fringe of the bedding area into the feeding area, setting trail cameras if that's legal, which most states it is, even during season, is going to help you pad those elk rat. And then, you know, you place your tree stand or your ground blind along one of those places. But again, the wind is going to be so critical. I've had people that are like, man, I've got this herd of elk on camera and they're there every day except for the day I go and sit, and I don't know, I must just be off. And, you know, they haven't paid attention at all to what the wind's doing, and the wind changes usually in, you know, mid-morning, while you're there sitting, and so you're paying attention to the wind, and then it changes, and the elk know that, and their movements are all based.
I think a lot of it has to do with approach too, though.
Yep.
How you're approaching your stands. Are you coming through where they're at already? I mean, you may not know that you're busting them out of there because, like you said, the scent, you know, can travel a couple hundred yards, and they're moving out of there before you even know. You know, and for those of you who don't know what edge is or what Corey's referring to is where two different habitats meet, usually creates, you know, where a thick, dense forest or a swamp edge or whatever meets an open field, or it doesn't even have to be an open field, it just be like a little break. It's those areas where the habitat changes, the edge between two different habitat types or two different types of vegetation usually produces good feed, and sometimes it could be cover, it could be, you know, tangled brush or whatever, but it's where the edge between two different habitat types and being able to recognize those things, you know, like a burn or you know, anything like that would really improve your chances of being able to get on a travel corridor or feeding area of where those elk are moving.
Totally. Yeah, and the two habitats you're looking at are usually feed and bedding. So if you've got an area that provides cover and then transitions into a feeding area, that transition phase between there is still usually going to offer decent cover and decent feed, and they're probably going to be more apt to spend time there rather than spend all day standing out in the open feeding or all day bedded. And, you know, just that finding those transition points, those edges and the fringes can be really critical, and especially if you're going to be hunting in a tree stand or from a ground blind, recognizing those areas and then, you know, scouting, finding fresh sign and setting up cameras and finding the elk and paying attention to the wind can be a very effective way to get a shot at an elk.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, man, I appreciate you taking the time to answer these questions. You know, where can our listeners find out more about you and what you do?
Totally, yeah. They can just visit us at elk101.com. We've got a really awesome educational resource that we're just launching this week. It's the University of Elk Hunting online course, and people can go on there and sign. Yeah, they can sign up for that and go through, and it walks through every single aspect of elk hunting, from planning to scouting to gear, physical preparation, elk knowledge. We talked about thermals, locating elk in the field, setting up, calling, tracking, packing, common challenges, miscellaneous elk hunting tactics, just everything about elk hunting. The course is over 120,000 words long. It's got 60 video components, hundreds of images and diagrams. And, you know, if people want to save 30%, $30 on the course, they can enter the code John Stallone, all one word, spelled out.
That's awesome.
And that'll save them $30 when they sign up for the University of Elk Hunting online course.
So no excuses, guys. Get in there, learn, be a student, figure it all out, and go get yourself a big bull this year.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for coming on and spending time with us today, and thank you for that code. That's awesome. Hopefully our listeners will utilize that and not be dum-dums and think they know everything. You can always you could always learn something. I mean, I read whole books to learn, you know, one little thing that I didn't know, you know. So,
totally.
Do that, get in there, check it out. Go check out elk101.com. And, man, thanks. Thanks for coming on, and I appreciate you. And if you want to come help me out on my late-season bull tag like you did that guy, I'm more than happy to help you over here in Arizona. I'll pay for your airfare.
That would be awesome. Cool. John, appreciate you having me on, and good luck to everybody this elk season.
All right. Take it easy.
All right.